The School Is Out podcast with Mike and Miles. We're all about asking questions and finding solutions for all things education. School is out. Now let's get started.
Hey, Miles.
Hey, Mike.
So we got another strategy to get it done.
What is the strategy?
Yeah, strategies to get it done. It's our series of vignettes, our smaller vignettes. Let's talk about how to get kids to want to read.
Okay.
So this is an edgy one. This is one of our more edgy topics because we know out there that structured literacy, science of reading is all over the place. And it is the prominent system for teaching kids how to read. But we're going to move a little bit away from teaching kids how to read and get into more of teaching kids how to want to read.
So let me just clear up what you said there. You said the science of reading is how we teach kids to read. We're going to be talking about how we get kids to want to read.
Yeah, and if you're a returning listener, you know that this is a baited conversation already. You know that this one's coming out of a cannon. So
we could already just end this right now because we talked about this a little bit in the Snacks and School Lunch podcast, one of my favorite podcasts that we did. But Pizza Hut figured this out in the 80s. It's done and solved. Book it, solve the problem.
They sure did. So did Accelerated Reader. You know, if you think about it, what's fascinating too is anybody who listens to this who is either like a Title I teaching reading instructor or somebody who is very deeply ingrained in science of reading instruction, the fact that I said Accelerated Reader, they're already cringing going, no, you can't make reading competitive. What about if the kids are competitive? That's all I got to say. Not every kid is not competitive. But anyway, I digress.
And when we talk about this topic, Mike, I think it's about reading for sure, but it's also about education as a whole. How do we get kids to want to read? We know how to teach. We've talked about this. Socrates was a great teacher. The methods that we have to convey information to people and have them understand it and do things, they're pretty solid. The motivation, the reason why, is what we struggle with. And sometimes our methods decrease interest and motivation rather than increase.
Yes.
They kill the love or desire rather than instill. And I think that's a lot of what we'll talk about today.
Yeah. And let's just take a look at some of those methods right now. That way we can get some of the negatives out of the way right now so we can focus on more of the positives. So reading fluency, getting kids to read. If you know, everybody who's listening to this podcast knows exactly how I feel on worksheets. Let's give kids worksheets that have paragraphs on them and say, you need to read these. And when I tell you, you need to read them, I want you to answer a couple questions on them too, so that now we have some comprehension behind all of that. Hey, guess what? It's still a white piece of paper with a whole bunch of black words on it that look just like the one that you gave for math, that look just like the one that was given for social studies, that look just like the one that was for centers work. It looked just like every other one given in that child's educational life. And now they're getting those same worksheets from kindergarten to 12th grade. And we're saying, why aren't you learning from these? Or why aren't you developing a love for what we're doing in class based on these worksheets? So there's one. Two, let's look at the content that we're throwing out for every child to read. We're canning up something that's supposedly good for everyone, if that could be an issue. So, hey, guess what we're going to read about today? We're going to read about how, you know, this person's job is going to relate to their past and how that's emotional for them or whatever the topic. It doesn't interest me, but I have to read it because it's good for me. We've talked about that before. We're doing this because it's good for you. I'm not buying that. I'm sure there's a couple other things. I mean, we could even throw out that, hey, science of reading isn't how I learned. I don't really like marking up words. I don't really care that, you know, a vowel between two consonants is a short vowel, and therefore I don't care about reciting the rules per se. Show me the word cat and I memorize that it's cat. That's sight word reading, and maybe that's more for me. And I know that in itself is blasphemy, but you know what, it worked for me. I'm not saying that Signs of Reading wouldn't work for me. I'm just saying it's not about getting me to do something. It's how do you get me to want to do something?
And I don't think we have to make the whole thing about the science of reading, but I want to talk about that for a second, Mike. If, and I was in a session a little while ago, I was listening to an expert talk about the science of reading, and in their talk, or I guess the prevailing idea that I keep seeing behind the science of reading is that it's settled science that this is how people learn to read best. And I guess my only question would be, if that is true, then how did people for the last couple thousand years learn to read in different ways other than with just that? And they would say, well, this is how we learn. This is how we learn best. This is the best way to do it. And that may be true, but think about our one idea that we always talk about, student-centered, individualized instruction. The science of reading is not a student-centered, individualized approach. I'm sorry, it's not. And I don't want to make anyone too upset, but student-centered, individualized. The science of reading in the formats that I've seen it presented is a canned program. Everyone does this, boom, 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 boom. If everyone does this, why doesn't everyone get the same results? And then what those people fall back on is, well, it's the experiences that you bring into the classroom, right? It's the number of words that you've heard before you make it to kindergarten or in the home or the support that you get outside of school. So it's not just the science of reading. It's all of these other things that may or may not make someone successful. And if the science of reading just doesn't produce the same exact results, guess what? Your science is a little off.
Yeah. And I think people out there, they might know that trends are starting to move again to a blended form of reading instruction that doesn't discount other ways of teaching reading. But again, this episode isn't all about teaching reading. It's about encouraging kids to want to read. How do you get somebody to want to do something? You've got to grow their brain and grow and present them with so many different options and model what you want done. And I've said it before, I'm 47 years old and I read what I want to read. I might pick up a book and read it that's on professional practice. There's all kinds of professional material out there that I read, and some of it is pretty deep. But as you know, I mean, you've probably forgotten more books than I've ever read. But at the same time, I choose what I read because I have an interest in that path right now. It might be fiction. It might be nonfiction. It might be centered on curriculum and instruction. It doesn't matter. But I have learned to want to read things that I want to read.
And remember, Mike, we started off one of our really early podcasts was what's the goal? Okay. And we were talking about the big goal for all of education. But let me ask this. What's the goal with reading instruction in our schools? What's the goal? To me, yeah, of course, you want people to be literate. You want them to have fluency. You want them to be good critical readers. You want them to have all of those comprehension skills. The overall goal, when I get my kids to the end of 12th grade, I want them to have all those skills, but at the same time, I want them to love reading, to enjoy reading, whether it's nonfiction, fiction, whatever it is. We need a strong literate society. If your program makes people leave with negative associations with reading, you have failed. We could pull up some research right now. A large percentage of students are graduating from high school with negative associations with reading, which means knock your head off the wall all you want. I want my kids to be super fluent, to have all these awesome skills we're working on. If they never put them to practice after they graduate, what's the point?
Exactly. So if we do look at reading in an elementary school or even in middle school, we have decoding and we have fluency and comprehension. So decoding is, are you able to understand what the glyphs mean? Can you decipher the code, if you will, of reading? We have fluency is, how quickly can you do it? And then comprehension, do you understand what the meaning of the words are, is? So do you understand what they all mean? That's all great and good. But like you said, Miles, if I don't care to do that, then what's the point of any of it? And let's go back to some 1980s instruction that I was kind of put on. So immediately, and if you think about it, what I'm about to explain is going to sound a little bit like what we do now. When it was reading time, we had like a basal reader, if you will. We had a book that we opened up and we read some paragraphs out of it. There was a couple questions at the end. We talked about it, but every teacher came together. They put some groups of kids together and then we all went our separate ways. And in each group, the groups were usually named after some animal or some color or whatever. And now we think, well, that's so insensitive to do that to kids. Like we had the chickadee group, the cardinal group, and we had the blue jay group. Well, it doesn't take a second grader really long to figure out what group they're in. Because if Bobby was the smart kid, and he's always been the smart kid and answers all the questions right up front, any kid who's in his group must be just like him. So they're going to that group. So the chickadees are the smart group. Now you're starting to wonder, well, which group am I in? So immediately second graders, even first graders are thinking, I know where I am. I know where I know where you think I belong. Now, the problem is, look what we're doing right now. We start talking about intervention groups. And we start saying, well, we're going to pull small groups in our classroom, which isn't bad. That's not a bad thing to pull small groups. But if you pull an intervention group, and let's say that your intervention group with these four kids meets every single day, and your second intervention group has a group of kids that only meets once a week, do you think those kids can't figure out what's going on? Oh, wait, there's a third intervention group. That's where a Title I specialist comes and takes a group to her smaller class size, to her room. You think those kids don't know what's going on? They know exactly what's going on. So we have a Title I specialist taking kids. We have an intervention group in a classroom that happens every day. And we might have another intervention group that happens once a week. Believe me, kids know what's going on. I'm not knocking that system as long as that system encourages the love of reading and focuses less on you're behind grade level. I need to get you somewhere. And if we're not seeing kids getting somewhere and they're starting to turn off of reading, whatever we're doing is wrong.
And I don't really know what to say because I don't want to say the wrong things, but some of those things that I hear from reading specialists, reading teachers, people who work with students about reading, it's always focused on those things. Are they on grade level? Their word per minute came up. Their fluency score came up and all of those things. Just take a step back and think about what I said before. Individualized student-centered approach. Each student is an individual in our class that learns at different speeds, that have different skills and abilities. When you say on grade level, when you say this number of words per minute, whatever, you're being compared to this larger group that is just a norm-based group. It's an individual. It's all individual. They're placed into a class of third graders based generally on age. But that is all. They need to be seen as individuals. And is the second you start taking those tests and measuring that, I'm telling you, consciously, subconsciously, the adults working with those students start to form opinions about the skill and ability of those students. And once they do, they're treated differently. Mm-hmm. And once they're treated differently, they start to see reading differently. And once they see reading differently, the kids that feel like they're being successful and doing well most likely are going to enjoy that because they're getting those external rewards and that gratification for doing what they're doing. And the kids that feel like they're struggling are going to naturally pull back from that and start to develop negative associations with that because they think they're struggling with it. Our schools teach them they're struggling with it rather than just saying everyone's learning to do this together. Yes, we recognize maybe some areas of need and this group needs a little bit different approach or whatever, but at this benchmark, oh my gosh, we form these groups and you're probably never going to catch up if you don't get on grade level. Stop with all that for a little bit and just relax and teach people to love to read.
Yeah, in our pre-talk a little bit, something stood out with me that you said, and it had to do with your boy and library. We have library as a special, a lot of schools around the country do. And you said that your boy is fascinated right now with the formation of America and has been bringing home books from the library about that and has been just throwing fits at home on reading his homework piece from class, which is probably a paragraph on a worksheet, which I'm not, whole separate thing, whatever. And he's saying to you, can we read this book, please, about this thing that's interesting to me? I'm guessing that book isn't part of the resources within our curriculum and is now something that he is highly desiring to read, but that's not what's being required of him through class. And so now we're in a bit of a fight. I guess there's a moral fight. There's a real fight with your son, but kind of talk about that if you would.
Well, Mike, you know, and we've talked about this, but I have a couple of goals for my kids, but one of my goals for my children is that they enjoy reading. So we read in our house, and we have read to all of our children since before they were born, literally before they were born. And we love books. I mean, we have more books than we have space for in my house, and we pick them up. And I want my kids to always find pleasure and enjoyment in those books and those stories. And when it's a very difficult thing, and parents out there who may be in a similar situation to mine can empathize, when homework comes home and your child tells you they don't want to do it, you're up against it a little bit, because I am going to have my children do the work that comes home. That's just something that they're going to learn is very important. But at the same time, how do I get them to do that and fulfill that expectation and not hate the activity that I'm asking them to do? So, you know, I know that my kids read for a long time at school every day, and then more reading comes home and they want to do other things, or they want to read something else, but we're going to get through this worksheet because it's what the school is asked to do. And we're always going to do what the school asks you to do. And then it's like, it's literally a battle to get through that. I don't want to battle people about reading. I want reading to be fun, enjoyable, and exciting. It's very difficult to get those two things to happen when it's a battle. And it hurts me. It hurts my soul a little bit when I go through that. And I've read books on the subject. My wife and I have tried many, many different strategies to get around that, and we're still not around it because it's something that is just very difficult. I don't want to do this anymore, Dad. I want to build with my Legos. And yes, I'll read with you at night. And yes, I love it when you take me to the library and we go to the stack and we pull books out on things that are cool. And I want you to read that to me or whatever. And that's the things that I want to do. And then we're battling about the couple paragraphs on the worksheet. It's difficult. It's really difficult.
Yeah. And I think if we get back to the strategies piece on how to get that done, if you're a teacher in a classroom, if you're a principal in a school, you might be a little bit buttoned up in this case. Sometimes I feel that I am at times, and I'm going to be careful how I express that, because again, I am employed and have to pay the bills. But at the same time, if we think back to our earliest memories, and maybe everybody doesn't have this, but those who do should share the fact that they do, because I would like our community to get back to this understanding of how do you develop a love of reading. Being read to as a child is a very special event. That is a very, very special event. It's indelible for me. In my youngest years, when my Aunt Isla was helping raise me, when my mom was ill, I remember sitting on a rocking chair. That rocking chair is in my living room. And just being rocked and read to. And I have the books still that she read to me. I would, they, when I see these things, they warm my heart. They have such deep meaning for me. I'm looking at two of them right now that my Uncle Orvis read to me. That was Aunt Isla's husband. So Uncle Orvis was a scientist. He taught science in high school, and he bought me two books. They were from Golden Press, and I'm looking at one right now. It's called Reptiles and Amphibians. I loved it. I can tell you right now what page the Gila monster is on. I love that, you know, and I can tell you all about the Gila monster. It doesn't have teeth, but it's a very poisonous reptile. And then the other is Family of Birds. And I, you know, we grew up that way, reading about things, but then Aunt Isla would read to us or read to me. And I have this old book of nursery rhymes. And, you know, that was kind of back when nursery rhymes were a little bit faux pas, where they are now. But, you know, I can remember those nursery rhymes. And it, I remember that switch when I wanted to start reading those things to her. And I wanted to start reading about those amphibians to Uncle Orvis. And then I wanted to share my reading. Like, I would find things that I wanted to share with adults and be like, let me read this to you. This is really cool. Look what I found. And that it kind of developed for me. When I got the understanding of how to decode those words, however I did it, I then wanted to share those things because of that love that was all around when I was being read to, and then I was then reading back. You know, if we could duplicate that in a classroom, there is the essence. And I go back to where your boy was bringing back library books. If we still have library class, they're going into a library full of books and finding books that interest them. How do we create the experience I just mentioned with the book that they find interesting?
You just gave the answer, Mike. And we have Read Across America Week coming up this week that celebrates reading. It celebrates Dr. Seuss. What's Dr. Seuss? Dr. Seuss, this was like just nonsensical, funny love of the creation of stories. And that's what reading is. The answer is, from the second you can start to work on those skills, the actual decoding and reading skills, however you want to teach them, putting things in front of people that they are interested in, that they enjoy, that they can latch on to. The same way you were just talking about, you know, those early reading experiences, I have them, and I think that probably so many people have them. Like, and when I read some of those same books, I mean, literally the same books that my mom read to me, to my kids, like, it's just an amazing experience that then, as a language arts person who taught that, doesn't come out when you're force feeding kids to read Great Expectations and literally teaching them to hate something as you're doing it. But I'm not going to get my kids, we're not going to get our kids in schools to love, I don't say not to read, to love reading, to enjoy it, by just forcing them to read anything. Well, this is a pretty high interest title. We think most people will like this. Move away from that. Freedom and choice and exploration, that's where we get to. That second grade CAN curriculum isn't going to get there. Mm-hmm. You can teach the same skills that they're teaching with that worksheet that comes home by allowing every kid in that class to find an on grade level topic. I know you can. Mm-hmm. I know you can. And I'm going to give a shout out to the Souderton Charter School Collaborative, which is a school that I encountered last weekend at a conference that I was at. But they presented on some things and they just threw something out that I had thought of. But in their school, they encourage students to do what's called a 100 book challenge. And the students have complete 100% freedom to try to read 100 books during the year. And when they were presenting about this, they talked a little bit about, well, some of the students, they think, it, you know, they have all these books on the shelves and they'll take the skinniest book or the book that they like the most. And they'll start with that. And that's a book off the list. And like, they're not tricking us. We just want them to read. It's not that you have to read a 200 page book. We want you to read and love the things that you're reading. Just build in the freedom and the choice. Every single kid that we have is interested in so many different things. Allow them to read about the things that they're interested in. Student-centered.
Yeah, I think you nailed it on the head. I think we both did, really. It's all about keeping that interest up and letting that reading experience be reciprocal. It doesn't always have to be one way, and then a grade gets put on their paper. They feel a certain way. They bring it home. Their parents start feeling a certain way. I mean, we already talked about what grades are in episode one, but it's when we do this to kids, it's hurting us more than we think that it's helping them. You know, what we're doing, if we're not seeing results, if we don't have kids loving to read, but they're reading, or if they're still fighting to read, that what we're doing is more for us than it is for them. We need to take a step back. We need to pull ourselves away from this experience as adults and look at this experience from the lens of a kid. You know, are they getting that experience that you and I talked about, where I'm being read to and now I'm reading back? When that doesn't happen, we need to be cautious. We need to look at what's going on. Are books in kids' hands? Because good reading means I see kids with books in their hands, or with something in their hands that they want to read, and they're going through it and they're talking about it afterwards.
Go ahead, Mike.
No, please. No, go ahead. I want to hear it.
I'm going to give you a good litmus test that we can know that we have failed, education has failed, and that we need to shift gears. Go to a group of adults, and I would go to a group of teachers and say, how many books have you read in the past year? How many books have you read in the past 5 years? Now, there are going to be some voracious readers in your group, I guarantee it. But there are also going to be a lot of people that don't read books. Now go to a group of high school students. Say, how many books have you actually read in the last year? Not how many books have you spark noted and fake filled in the blanks on those tests that you're taking. I mean, genuinely read and wanted to read. Middle school kids. I do this with kids in middle school all the time. What's the last book you actually read? Do you like reading? The answers that you get are surprising, but they're also hurtful sometimes. And you know, we have so many kids going through school that don't read and don't like to read.
So that is telling, and it's sad at times. It's encouraging at other times. But when you look at the raw number of what you're talking about, I think it's more telling and sad at times, because, you know, that's one of the first things that you hear. This isn't going to be news to anybody, but if you start asking kids when they turn away from education, those kids are also going to be kids that don't read. I guarantee you, they find no love in reading. And what's the number one thing that after kids read to learn, what's the number one thing that they do to learn? They have to read. That is a correlation that doesn't take much to connect. So if, you know, not to like put stuff out there, but if we do talk about like Scarborough's rope and all the things that go into learning to read, reading is an input, and the output of reading is spelling. So we said that we were going to talk a little bit about spelling in addition to reading. I mean, the two are linked. They are directly linked. You know, if it's a rule for reading, it's a rule for spelling. But I find it fascinating to talk about spelling. I know that you've said before that you are not a good speller. You're a voracious reader, but not a good speller. I would call myself not a good speller. But I would say, especially now that I'm an 80s kid, 90s kid, and have grown up with all these things, guess what is the number one thing that has helped me with spelling? It certainly is not knowing how to decode words. It is not knowing the rules of decoding, because I was not taught those. The number one thing that helped me learn to spell is making mistake after mistake after mistake on a word processor and having it highlight it and asking me to right click and fix it.
I want to talk about spelling, Mike, because It's something that has honestly really always bothered me. And I've done reading and research on it because of that, because I've told you, and I think I've said on the podcast, I am not a good speller. And I know that, especially even with this science of reading, that spelling and reading go hand in hand a lot of times in the instruction, because some of this is personal. I see this thing that my kids are doing in school, and they take spelling tests in school, right? The same kind of spelling test that I took all throughout elementary school and would study the words with my mom every single night and memorize them and get them. And I think there was like 15 words and then 5 challenge words at the end. Those are in me. I am an awful speller. I could go through those activities 1,000 times out of 1,000 times and try to memorize how to spell that word and then get to the spelling test and spell it incorrectly. And what I want to say on the podcast, I think it's important, is that they have scientifically identified that spelling is a genetic trait, and everyone has within them a gene that is either turned on or turned off that makes you genetically either a good speller or someone who doesn't have that ability to spell well. And the science beyond that is a little beyond me to explain right now, but Albert Einstein, awful speller. Ernest Hemingway, awful speller. A lot of great authors, awful spellers. And what I wanted to say was that was one experience throughout my education that started to turn me off from school a little bit, because I like to do things and do them well. And that was something that I struggled with. And now, you know, as I said, that's a genetic trait. I see my son and he brings home the spelling test and he might, whatever it is, 80% on the spelling test. We said grades are fake. But when the teacher reads the word, when he writes it, he always writes it phonetically. He writes it the way it sounds. He's learned the sound that the letters make and he writes that out, but it's marked wrong, right? I mean, to me, that's right. And that proves that has learned those phonetic rules and is spelling the word. And that's pretty much how I spell. And I write stuff all the time, and I consider myself to be a pretty strong writer. I've got Microsoft Word or I've got my Google Docs. And those little red lines tell me when I spelled something wrong. I know what the word is. The line comes up and I right click the word and it puts in the right spelling and I'm good. And I can read the words and I can write the words, but I don't have to know how to spell the words. And I told you, I could study them from now until the cows come home. I am not going to be able to spell them well. Albert Einstein couldn't spell them well, but he was Albert Einstein. I want to move away from the right, wrong, 80% on the spelling a little bit, because I think it's part of that. How do we get kids to love school, to love to read?
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. Those things are going to come along for the ride when they are engaging in the skill that they love, which is reading. When they engage in the skill that they love, which is writing about what they read, if what they read was interesting to them, those things will come. And if they don't, at least they still enjoy doing them. I think that output of writing is one of the easiest things to kind of blow off. I mean, like I said, who cares? It's not one of those situations where you're going to get caught in the grocery line and be embarrassed that you spelled something wrong. That's not going to happen. You know, those examples are so rare. You're going to be able to write and express yourself. And I guess I had a professor in college that was really keen on this. And he was, I don't know whether you want to say that he had an inferiority complex, but I heard him crush a kid one time. And it was interesting. And I shouldn't laugh at it, but it was an English professor. And we were in a class and this kid said something. And then from across the room was corrected grammatically. And the professor just stopped everything and was like, I want to just be clear about something right here, right now. Did you understand what that child was saying before you corrected them? Did you understand the meaning behind his words before you stopped and corrected him? Well, yeah. Then who cares? You know, we've got to get back to the point of what's the function, what's the goal. The function is to want to read. The function is to be able to write, to express yourself. And if we make mistakes, we can always learn forward. There's nothing wrong with that. And the more and more we make mistakes, the more and more we learn. We've got to be okay with that.
And that's the thing with spelling, Mike, I think I was trying to get to, and I've always had a hard time with some approaches to school. I could sit down and write a story, handwrite it. And it could be like more creative and more well thought out and well crafted than maybe the other 19 kids in the room. But one approach, the teacher would sit down and just read that thing out with all the words that I misspelled. And I would get a 50% on my writing because I misspelled all these words. Or the other approach, the teacher could look at it holistically and say, this is an amazing story. Now let's use the other tools at our disposal to get those words spelled correctly, because they do have to be spelled correctly. And let's praise the work you have done. We get hung up on the details that don't mean anything. And that makes people hate something like reading. Mm-hmm. And we need to move away from that. So I think to bend this all back to the strategies to get it done, like my number one strategy to get it done, to get kids to love to read, to give them that freedom and choice to read things that are interesting to them. The answer can't be, well, yeah, we'll get to that later. Like, we'll teach you how to do this, and then we'll let you get to all the stuff that you want to learn how to read later. The later doesn't come soon enough for a lot of people. As soon as they can get those words decoded, get things in front of them that they want to read. Not that you think they want to read, that they want to read. That's the number one strategy that I pulled out of this from to get it done, to get kids to love to read.
Bingo. I'm not gonna say anything more to that, because that's the exact essence of the podcast, of today's episode. You know, and for me, it's that analogy, it's that story, it's something. And I go back to The Hunt for Red October. This is what started my career. That movie had a line in it that was so impactful. I've mentioned it. I know I've had to have mentioned it before, but you know, when Alec Baldwin is in front of a mirror and he's shaving and he's saying, the problem isn't how do you get 100 people to get off of a nuclear submarine? How do you get 100 people to want to, and he stops and he figured out his solution right there. How do you get people to want to get off that submarine? Look around you. Look around. What do you have in front of you? If you're a classroom teacher, look at what you have around you. You have books in your classroom. Are those books flying off the shelves? They should be. You have a library. Those books should be flying off the shelves. Those kids should be talking to each other and talking to you and talking to their parents. So that's how you get it done.
That's exactly how to get it done for reading and everything else, Mike. You make it personal, and you let kids decide what they want to do, what interests them. We'll keep talking about those things in other episodes, but the way is there. The way is there. And take all those workbooks, take all those worksheets, put them on the shelf.
Yeah.
Put them in the trash can. Build it with you and your students.
Yes.
I'm sorry, Mac O'Shea. You don't want to read this fake thing. What do you like? Let's go find that. Let's do the same thing with the stuff that you like. And then, the whole point of this is to learn from it and talk about it in the first place. So then we get to do that. Exactly. We get to talk about what you learned. Then it's real.
Exactly. Well, I think that's it for us today. This was good. It was a good discussion. We tried to keep it a little less edgy than it could have, which I'm very okay with it going the other direction, but I think we did a good job with this, exploring, you know, reading and how to get that done and in your classroom. Next week we'll have another good one, so stick around.
Okay, sounds good, Mike. Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been the Schools Out Podcast. Continue the conversation and explore past and future episodes at schoolisout.org.